I knew as soon as I heard that.
Bring the House Committee on Energy and Environment to order. And committee and folks that are here with us today, I have a number of bills that I'm going to carry over until Monday. So if you hear your bill, you can wait until Monday. Carrying over House Bill 2131, the work session on House Bill 2131 until Monday, April 17th. I'm carrying over House Bill 2135 to April 17th. I'm carrying over House Bill 2481 till April 17th. Carrying over House Bill 2706 to April 17th. I'm carrying over House Bill 2710 to April 17th. And I'm carrying over House Bill 3269 to April 17th. And I'm carrying over House Bill 3386 to April 17th. Session on House Bill 2236. Beth, can you tell us where we're at with this bill?
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2236, you heard on 327, there's a no revenue and a fiscal impact issued on the measure. It directs the Department of Environmental Quality to conduct a study on air contaminants from industrial sources, develop recommendations, and deliver reports to the Legislative Assembly. There is a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
I'd accept a motion on this bill.
Chair Helm, I move House Bill 2236 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Power moves House Bill 2236 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Breschke?
Aye.
Representative Oxman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Powers?
Aye.
Chair Hall?
Aye. The motion passes, and House Bill 2236 is referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. At this time, I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2269. Beth, can you give us an update here?
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2269, you originally heard on 327. It also has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. There's dash 3 amendment, which removes the sections modifying the Schedule 4 sources subject to federal operating permit under Title 5 of the Federal Clean Air Act. There's a dash 4 amendment that establishes a specific activity to fund investigations of complaints related to sources subject to federal operating permitting fee. And it establishes a one-time supplemental fee at a base amount of $1,256 plus $9.49 per ton of each regulated pollutant during the 2016 calendar year. There's a revenue impact issued and a fiscal impact issued on the dash 4 amendment.
Okay. Are you going to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2269.
Representative Johnson moves the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2269 Did you want to discuss that?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. Committee members, these amendments are intended to, I think, preserve the parts of the bill that are very valuable. It talks about the disposition of some of the VW settlement money in ways that are very helpful, I think, for retiring some of our aging diesel fleets and so forth in a way that is needful and helpful. It does remove the parts of the bill that I think will be huge cost drivers for industry and impose hardships upon them with very little data, frankly, to back up the costs that are intended to be imposed upon them. So that's why I would suggest we pass it dash threes.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to stand at ease for a moment. Reopening the work session on House Bill 2269. At this time, will the clerk call the roll?
Mr. Chair, this is on the motion to adopt the dash three amendment.
I'm sorry.
Is
yes,
that right?
It is.
Thank you.
You're quite
sure I understand what we're voting on.
Yes. Let me back up. You're quite right. Representative Johnson has made a motion to adopt the dash three amendments, and we were just past discussion on that. And the motion in front of us is to adopt the dash three amendments or not. And with that, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
No.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Colby?
No.
Representative Marsh?
No.
Representative Reschke?
Aye.
Representative Ron Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Power?
No.
Chair Holmes?
No. The amendment fails. Is there another motion?
Chair Holm, I move to adopt the Dash 4 amendment dated April 10th, 2017.
Representative Power moves to adopt the Dash 4 amendment dated April 10, 2017. Is there any discussion? No further discussion on the Dash 4s? Any objection on the Dash 4s?
Yes.
Will the clerk please call the roll on the Dash 4 amendment, please?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative
Benz? No. Representative Colby?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative
Rushen?
No.
Representative Rocksmith?
No.
Vice Chair Johnson?
No.
Vice Chair Power?
Aye.
Chair
Holm?
Aye.
The motion passes. Chair Holm, I move House Bill 2269 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Power moves House Bill 2269 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I've said, I think in our hearing we've heard that this is a bill that's looking for a solution that to a problem that it's really hard to identify. We just don't have data to know what sort of emissions could be potentially responsible for elevated elements of whatever chemical are in play here. I think we're getting the cart before the horse. We need better data before we can start to levy fees and fines and assessment on industrial customers, and I think this will be a really bad bill for Oregon's economy.
Any further discussion? Okay. Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
No.
Representative Colby?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Reschke?
No.
Representative Rocksmith?
No.
Vice Chair Johnson?
No.
Vice Chair Power?
Aye.
Aye.
The motion passes, and the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. At this time, I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2707.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2707 appropriates an undetermined amount from the general fund to the Water Resources Department for groundwater studies investigations. The dash one amendment that you have on OLIS is appropriates $8.2 million from the general fund to Water Resources Department for groundwater studies investigations or other groundwater data gathering and analysis needed to assess and manage Oregon's groundwater resources and priority basins determined by the department. There's a no revenue impact in a fiscal statement issued on the dash one amendment, and there is a subsequent referral to the Committee on Joint Ways and Means.
Thank you. So, committee members, you remember we heard this as part of the three water bills that came before us. earlier in the session, and there was, I don't know if it was unanimous, but there was strong support for more groundwater studies to be accomplished by the department. What I asked Water Resources to do was to go back and give us a number that would represent the cost, the total cost of doing groundwater studies in their priority basins, which they've already identified as needing work. And so that's what this number represents. I think we all know what the budget situation is. And what I intend to have this bill do is set a marker down in Ways and Means to let the folks that are watching this work also know what it's going to take to accelerate the pace at which we do these vital groundwater studies in the state so that we help the users understand what's available to them. With that, I'd accept a motion on this bill.
Chair Helm, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated April 6, 2017.
Representative Power moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated April 6, 2017. Is there any discussion? Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for this bill. I'm surprised at the modest number, even though $8 million is a lot of money. I'm familiar with the work that's been done in the Deschutes Basin, and it's been extraordinarily expensive. This would be a good start. There's no doubt that the state of Oregon, as the owner of the water of the state, since it's public, has the duty to figure out what the nature's extent, sustainability of this resource truly is, and this is something that should have been done years ago and just hasn't. So we've been left with a system that is kind of a try it and see how it works, as opposed to knowing exactly what it is we have available. And so I think it would be a good start. I'm anxious to find out where that money might come from. I think there's broad reasons for this to be a general fund revenue source, because it's in everyone's interest to know what it is that we rely so heavily upon. So thank you for bringing the bill.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay. Is there any objection to the Dash 1 amendment? Mm-hmm. Seeing none, the amendment passes.
Chair Helm, I move House Bill 2707 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Power moves House Bill 2707 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any further discussion? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be a no, not because I don't think groundwater research is unimportant, but I know we allocated some money to this legislature, allocated money to OWRD in recent years for groundwater research. And when somebody comes and asks me for more money, I'd like to find out how the money was previously used and what we learned. And that was not the case brought forward, just that we need more money to do more research. And on that, I'm going to be a no.
Okay. Thank you. Further discussion? Okay, seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Reschke?
No.
Representative Brocksmith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Powers?
Aye.
Chair Hall?
Aye. The motion passes, and the bill will be sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, it's going to Ways and Means? Okay. All right.
Big fiscal.
Yes, that's right. Okay. At this time, I am opening a work session on House Bill 2711.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2711. You originally heard on 3-8. The measure imposes a statewide moratorium on hydraulic fracturing until 2026. The Dash 1 amendment available in OLS extends the moratorium until December 31st, 2027, and specifies that only coal bed methane extraction wells that were in the existence as of the effective date of the Act are excluded from the definition of hydraulic fracturing. There's a no revenue impact and a no fiscal impact on the Dash 1 amendment.
So, committee, we heard this bill earlier. The amendment clarifies a promise I made to some of our representatives down near Coos Bay. There were some exploratory wells drilled for coal bed methane extraction down there. And so the investments were previously made, and it doesn't look like that that business venture is going to continue, but just out of respect for that previous investment, we have carved those out of the bill, as with a couple of other categories of locales around the state, such as the mist. They are storage beds, actually, that Northwest Natural uses to hold some of their gas and reserve in a natural area. With that, I'd accept a motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendment.
Chair Helm, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated March 8th, 2017.
Representative Power moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated March 8th, 2017. Is there any discussion? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the intent in the bill, but I think also from the hearing, it does appear to me that we have adequate regulatory framework to monitor projects like this if they should occur. But further, I guess, with the rapidly changing landscape within the energy world, I don't think it's a wise move to, limit Oregon's ability to, provide for natural resources. So I'll be no.
Okay. Thank you. Any further discussion on the Dash 1 amendment? I'll have the clerk call the roll on the Dash 1 amendment, please.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
No.
Representative Colby?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Rushkey?
No.
Representative Brocksmith?
No.
Vice Chair Johnson?
No.
Vice Chair Power?
Aye.
Chair
Hall? Aye. The amendment is adopted.
Chair Helm, I move House Bill 2711 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Power moves House Bill 2711 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And of course, we've seen this bill before, and I apologize for making the same argument 2 years later. But the process of underground fracturing has progressed amazingly over the past 50 years. And it has, I think, resulted in a dramatic decrease in CO2 in the United States. And it's, I think, one of the primary reasons that we've had such success in meeting many of the standards so far to prevent Oregon from two things, from trying to generate gas for that continued positive environmental purpose. It seems odd. And then secondly, I've discussed the issue with Dogami repeatedly and been assured that we have the proper protective arrangements in place. As I mentioned 2 years ago, when I was researching it at that time, I looked at the other Governor Brown, Jerry Brown, and found out, of course, that he supports underground fracturing because, in his opinion, it's prevented us from having to import massive amounts of fuel from foreign nations and has resulted in us being far more energy secure. So there's incredibly good reasons for us to pursue this particular practice. I would say I had the great good fortune to attend the Lehigh Conference over the summer and then in November and learned, of course, that this process is happening worldwide, Canada, everywhere else, and there is an amazing amount of natural gas. I will simply point out that our ban here will result in perhaps losing some of the 6% royalty that otherwise would be paid to the state in its school fund that would be generated by gas from these types of wells. I will also point out that in my county, there are currently leases in place on private land for natural gas. On the Idaho side, there are currently 12 wells producing natural gas and selling into the grid. And it seems odd that we a short mile away from that resource would be passing this type of law. So I'll be a no.
Thank you. Further discussion? Okay. Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
No.
Representative Colby?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Rushkey?
No.
Representative Blackstone?
No.
Vice Chair Johnson?
No.
Vice Chair Power?
Aye.
Chair Helm?
Aye. The motion passes, and I'll carry this on the floor, please. At this time, I'm opening a work session on House Bill 3105.
Mr. Chair and committee members, you heard this bill on 410. The Dash 1 amendment replaces the measure, prohibits manufacturer, retailer from selling or offering sale covered product unless the covered product is labeled with brand and brand is included in the plan for a stewardship program. Requires stewardship program to submit a plan to DEQ describing how they will finance, manage, and conduct statewide stewardship program, provide for environmentally sound management of covered products, provide advertising, coordinate with architectural paint stewardship program, and provide convenient service. It declares an emergency effective on passage. There's a minimal revenue impact and a fiscal impact issued on the Dash 1 amendment. And there is a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. I would entertain a motion on the amendment.
Chair Helm, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated April 7, 2017.
Representative Power moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated April 7, 2017. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Chair Helm, I move House Bill 3105 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Power moves House Bill 3105 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the intent here. Again, I think that there's much more work that could be done on this bill, identifying the type of products, the labeling, the cost of taking care of those products on the shelf and so forth. But the other issue that was a big one for me that I really don't think we had clarity on or disclosure on was about DEQ and just how are they equipped to manage this program as well and enforce it. Again, how many FTE are we talking? What are the long-term costs or impacts on their budget? So it's got a lot of gray areas, or a lot of confusing, I think, components for me. So I will be a no.
Any other discussion? Representative Bentz.
Mr. Chair, the stewardship programs I've learned about starting 10 years ago or 10 sessions ago when then Representative Ben Cannon brought one of the first stewardship programs forward and lots of interesting discussion and later, of course, with the paint recycling program, which I think almost everybody here supported. And it was reflective of an enormous amount of really hard work, careful thought, and an understanding of how the system worked. And I think it's working well today. Stewardship programs have a place, but they have to be so carefully designed to merge with our curbside systems and make sure we're not inadvertently damaging those really good arrangements we already have in place for disposal of these types of waste. The thing that's always bothered me about these, of course, has been what other states are doing it or are not, what impact it has upon low-income people who actually have to buy the same products that are now going to go up in cost by virtue of this particular means of stewardship. And it deserves a great deal of work. This is an interesting start. This may have a future, but a lot more work. So I'll be a no.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
No.
Representative
Colby?
Aye.
Representative
Marsh?
Aye. Representative
Rusty?
No.
Vice Chair Johnson?
No.
Vice Chair Power?
Aye.
Chair Helm?
Aye. The motion passes, and the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. So, committee, House Bill 3202 is ready to work today, but we have one more piece of information to gather on it. I think we'll be able, for folks that are in the room watching this bill, we'll be able to work on it today. Are you ready to roll on
your
bill?
Sure, you bet.
Okay. So we'll hold off on that, and I'm going to open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3349. And Representative Johnson, you want to present? Okay, and Representative Huffman as well, please come forward.
Welcome.
Thank you.
You gonna set this up?
Yeah.
Chair Hill, members of the committee, for the record, Mark Johnson. I'm happy and privileged to be able to represent House District 52. We're going to talk about the Oregon Bottle Bill. I know many of us have been long-term supporters of the Bottle Bill. It's one of those iconic symbols of the state of Oregon. The Oregon Bottle Bill was first created back in 1971 to address the growing litter problem and to encourage sustainability and conservation. Oregonians got 5 cents for every bottle they returned to a participating grocery store. And originally, the authors of the Bottle Bill envisioned separate redemption centers to be located outside of grocery stores, but that vision didn't start to become a reality until 2011, as you'll hear. Then in 2011, when some of us were in the building, a few of us there on the dais, and my partner here to the right, the legislature passed House Bill 3145. This bill did a few things. It first of all increased the redemption value on containers from 5 cents to 10 cents, and that started in April of 2017, which of course we just experienced that a few weeks ago. But it also went on to expand the bottle bill to apply to a wider range of beverages, teas, coffees, fruit drinks, sport drinks, energy drinks in containers anywhere between 4 ounces and 1.5 liters. So a significant expansion of the containers, which again had broad bipartisan support at the time that it passed back in 2011. I was proud to be able to be a part of that. This expansion of the containers goes into effect on January 1st of 2018. So that's going forward just a few months from now. The bill also approved a pilot program to allow OBRC, the Oregon Beverage Recycling Commission, to create a redemption center separate from any other grocery store. The pilot program that they set up, and I think it worked very well. Come back to the 2013 session where we had Senate Bill 117. Also passed by the legislature, which allowed the OBRC to expand the redemption center pilot to try to take the program statewide. Because the pilot had been successful, and they found that it was increasing the overall rate of redemption, recycling, and so forth, and it was beginning to reduce the burden on grocery stores, and that's a very key component in all of this. But the issue was, of course, that it was only if successful in the area where that redemption center was available to residents. OBRC and grocers agreed at that time to work together on funding and expanding the number of redemption centers. Joe Gilliam, representing the grocers, testified that the grocers expect to see an increase in at least 40% the increase of bottle returns starting in 2018 as a result of this House Bill 3145. John Anderson, president of OBRC, testified, "Our intention is to open between 45 and 50 of these redemption centers." Rick, welcome, Senator. In the next few years, we're trying to open one every 3 months or 4 a year. So this gets us to the problem, and you'll notice a slide to your right over here. And to my knowledge, this represents the current number and current location of bottle drop redemption centers in the state of Oregon. And you can see which parts of the state are served well and which parts of the state may not be served well, depending on what you're looking at. The issue is that they only at this point in time have 19 redemption centers constructed and open for business to serve the state of Oregon. This is going to, in my opinion, create a huge strain on grocery stores, and it's going to prevent Oregonians from outside the urban areas from redeeming their bottles, which now, of course, are worth a dime and not a nickel. The solution, I believe, is what we have before you with House Bill 3349, which would simply delay the expansion of the containers until which time Oregonians can be served by a network that actually meets their needs. Can you click the next slide there, please?
Do not trust me.
There we go.
We thought that's why he brought you.
The next, yeah, he's my clicker.
This slide represents future bottle drop center locations as identified by OBRC. And again, these, to my knowledge, are bricks and mortar redemption centers where property is acquired, a facility is constructed, and it's an ongoing operational center. So it gets better. It does certainly get better. The plans are looking encouraging. But again, I think there still are parts of the state that aren't quite served. But I will notice there are, in this slide, there are at least service centers along the coast. Currently, there are none. That's quite a few tourists. That's quite a few population folks that are not being well served. Here we go. Now, this, to my knowledge, and I'm sure we'll hear testimony about this coming up, is what the ultimate plan looks like. Because OBRC, to their credit, has learned that it's acquiring bricks and mortar, or pardon me, acquiring land, constructing bricks and mortar to build permanent structures, first of all, can be time-consuming. First of all, it can be difficult because sometimes it's difficult, hard to find land in communities, especially in my community in Hood River. We just don't have vacant spots that are available at an affordable price to build this. What they're going to do is go to a series of containers, portable containers that can be placed on specific locations. You don't have to construct a permanent structure. You don't have to acquire property. You can quickly deploy these much more quickly than what the current program calls for. So I applaud their ingenuity and maneuvering and pivoting to try to make this available, but we're a long ways from having this built out. This is a future dream. I'll summarize, Mr. Chair, so I can get to my other colleagues. But I just want to quote an esteemed member of this body by the name of Senator Peter Courtney, who back in 2011 testified in favor of building redemption centers. He said, "Oregonians like to take their cans and bottles back. It's not a Democrat, it's not a Republican thing, it's not a rural, it's not an urban thing. It's not an Eastern Oregon thing as opposed to Central Oregon or the coast or the Portland thing. It's an Oregonian thing." And I think we're correct. I really think that summarizes the problem, Mr. Chair and committee members. With the redemption value now, the current menu of redeemable containers has risen to 10 cents. I really believe that more Oregonians than ever are going to want their money back, and I frankly think they deserve to have it back in a timely fashion. When the assortment of containers to be included in the program expands exponentially, I believe that retailers and non-served communities will be inundated with a virtual tsunami of cans and bottles and, frankly, very cranky customers who are not going to be happy with the chaos that's going to ensue. And many of them will be our constituents. Believe me, I'm already hearing from them ahead of this. So, again, I said OBRC is making progress. We're not there yet. Let's just take some more time, push the pause button, and let's wait until Oregonians can be well served. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Helm, committee members, John Huffman, State Rep for House District 59. And I just came to see my old buddy Jules to see what he's up to, and came to help, as my goal has always been in this body and since he left us, to help Jules succeed. That's purely my goal today. The last 10 years, as Representative Johnson said, we've had a few bottle redemption bills, and I've voted yes on every one of them, been very supportive. But the bills came with promises, and all I'm asking, and what this bill asks to do, is slow down a bit so the promises that I know are coming can catch up with where we are. I don't know how many of you have your little green bottle drop card and live down the street from a bottle drop location. It is really cool. And it's an experience that I want my constituents in rural Oregon to be able to experience. Just down the street from my house here in Salem, I just drive down Commercial at midnight, drop my bag in the back door, and then this $3 or whatever magically appears in my account, and it's really handy. I don't have to get all goopy from dropping the bottles through the machine that breaks down every third can and all that kind of stuff. You've heard the complaints, I'm sure. And so for those of us that live close enough to a bottle drop location, it's awesome, and I applaud them. They work well. We just need more of them. And I'm probably not even going to tell the story about being promised several years ago in one of the last maybe I am, where industry came to me and said, "John, the redemption value is never going to go to 10 cents. It's going to remain at 5 because the industry does not want it to go to 10 cents. And I said, well, how are you going to control that? How are you going to stop it? Well, a lot of people do curbside recycling, so it goes to the recycling centers, not the redemption centers. And so the industry is going to go buy back enough to get us up to or over that 80% threshold. Well, I don't know what happened to that plan, but that's gone. We're at 10 cents. We're staring at adding more containers to the 10 cents. And I just think, in all fairness to a lot of folks in Oregon that don't have a bottle drop, let's slow down a bit. Let's let the system catch up, because I think in a lot of ways it's working very well. And I can't see Jules behind me and what he's looking like right now, but I'm positive he agrees and he's gonna share my concern. So thank you for your attention, and I appreciate you listening.
Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Chair Helm. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Hansel, State Senator from District 29. I'm going to echo some of the comments from my colleagues. Oregonians are currently receiving 10 cents for every bottle they return to redemption centers or a grocery store. This applies to various types of containers, such as soda cans, bottles, and water bottles. The law was passed a few years ago, states the law that was passed, beginning January 1, 2018, a wider range of beverages, teas, coffees, fruit drinks, sports drinks, and energy drinks are eligible for a cash-back redemption, as long as they are in containers between 4 ounces and 1.5 liters. In 2011, distributors agreed to build bottle drop redemption centers to replace the grocery store centers. The problem, however, is that they haven't built these redemption centers. In 2011, OBRC promised to build 45 centers across the state, but today there are only 19. 9 of them are in the Portland metro area, 15 are located along I-5, and only one is located east of Bend. By having only 4 off the I-5 corridor, this puts a strain on grocery stores and prevents Oregonians outside of the urban areas from redeeming their bottles. Oregon loses money on all the bottles that are not redeemed, and it will lose even more when the bill applies to more beverage containers. Redemption centers need to be built in more areas. For example, my Senate district and Senator Ferrioli's Senate district, when put together, is the geographic size of the state of Pennsylvania. There is one redemption center in this entire area located in Hermiston. House Bill 3349 delays the expansion of the bottle bill to include tea, coffee, fruit drinks, sports drinks, and energy drinks until OLCC ensures that all Oregonians have convenient access to redemption centers. This bill does not affect the 5 or 10 cent redemption amount. It simply states that additional beverages will not be counted towards the program until redemption centers are located in more areas. The bill would also require OLCC report to the legislature on the regional breakdown of recycling returns. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to testify before your committee, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Wonderful. Any questions for our colleagues?
Here.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this idea. I like it. So I'm on the OLCC website looking at redemption rates. 2012 was 71%, 2013 about 71%, 2014 68%, 2015 64%. So we're on this downhill skid. We're hoping that the instead of getting one nickel, you get 2 nickels for every bottle you deposit will help increase that. I guess my question goes to, do we have the capacity to even implement 3145 if it goes into effect without being delayed? Do we have the capacity to handle all the new bottles?
Chair Helm and Representative Reschke, to handle the capacity with the increased redemption value, is that what you're suggesting?
And with the expansion of types of bottles.
I think that's a real concern. I think it's a valid question. If you can talk to retailers, again, stores who currently provide that service in my community, and they don't believe they do. Keep in mind that, It's been in certain communities, and I'm just speaking personally from Hood River here, it's been awful easy for certain retailers to kind of offload this responsibility to other retailers, and i.e. not maintain your machines well so that people stop going there and they go to the one place in town where they do work reliably, and that's where everybody goes. So it's a real concern, as I said. I can't imagine how we could get to January 1 with the current law in place and not have people who are going to be really exercised about the inability and the inconvenience of being able to get the redemption value back. And I would just make the point, I don't mean to be political about this, but I would say it also fairly regressive, because we know those folks at lower income are going to have a need to recoup their investment even more so than others. And by the time you add a dime to all these various containers, it can be real money, as you can imagine. It starts to add up. So thank you.
Just a quick follow-up.
One follow-up.
Does the bill leave it to OLCC to determine when we can expand that, or is there a metric saying that when we reach 40 of the 45 redemption centers or 30 of the 45, or when this is delayed, but do we have to take further action, or does it move forward when OLCC says so?
Representative, it says that when they can determine there's an adequate number of redemption centers to exist in the state, provide convenient service to all persons in the state. So we'll leave it up to them to make that determination.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And can you go back to your previous slide if you can figure out how to
go?
Did it go?
I just want to point out to everyone that the situation, I've been a big no on this for not because I'm not in favor of the bottle bill, but because of the massive amount of volume coming out of Idaho into Oregon. Hmm. And so I was just checking with my staff back in Ontario to see how it was working back now that I can't tell if that's a redemption center or what that is, and I've been gone for so long I have no idea what we have in our town. But I'm just curious if there was some
this is actually phase two, Representative.
Phase two, fine. Let's go back to there. We go.
I think that's close to today.
Yeah, there we go. That's how I think it is right now. No one. I don't think we have a one there yet. One has been planned and promised, but the talk about the tsunami of stuff coming out of Idaho into Oregon, it's a business opportunity, and a lot of people are taking advantage of it. So that burden is falling squarely upon the retail outlets in that area. So I welcome your bill. I'm not sure how much it's going to slow things down, given the now doubling of the value of these cans.
Chair Helm, just to tack on Representative Benson, I have the same issue with Washington. Mm. District 29 has probably the longest border of any of the Senate districts with the state of Washington, and the Tri-Cities, Walla Walla, all of that area, we're getting, because the way the distributors are, the cans can be redeemed in Oregon now. So we have the same issue that Representative Benson talked about.
Representative Brock Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson, Huffman, and Senator Hansel. As you can see, there's no redemption centers in my district, which is one of the reasons why I'm a sponsor of this bill, and appreciate the representative for bringing it forward, because as a border district, we have the same issue where a number of the folks from the California come up to shop in Oregon to avoid the 7.5% sales tax that they have in California, and it's a 15-minute drive for them to do so. In fact, it's one of the driving factors in the Southern Curry County economy. And even when you move a slide forward, there isn't a redemption center in my district. And then when you move the slide forward again, now we finally have some redemption centers where we can have at least the bottle drops there. So I really appreciate the bill and encourage. I didn't want to come down there and testify, but encourage our colleagues to support what Representative Johnson has brought forward here.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, just to close out, I in all seriousness, I was serious about helping Jules and Bottle Drop and to succeed. You know, whatever we can collaboratively do to make this work. But I think everybody's seen that rural Oregon is a big hole. And it's a nasty chore to take your bottles and stuff into Freddy's or Safeway or anywhere else. Thank you.
Thank you to all of you for being here today. And Senator Boquist, did you also want to testify?
I'll be very short, Mr. Chair.
Go right ahead.
For the record, Senator Brian Boquist, District 12. Obviously, I'm on the top of your bill head that's right there. I just wanted to add my 5 cents going to 10 cents worth here in trying to point out to you one of the issues that we do have is trying to determine the rest of rural Oregon in and out of my area. Actually, to date, this particular concept, strangely enough, has been, you know, quite successful. I think you've all seen the reports that are out there. And it would be more successful and easier for all of you from Portlandia and the urban areas when you drive out through my rural district, and you wouldn't see so many pop bottles and things along the road if we had the adequate number in the adequate places. And it would make a more pristine trip for all of you going out to the Deschutes area, as example, from your district in Eugene, Springfield. So I'm just adding my 2 cents to this, actually 5 cents or 10 cents, as I said. So I would appreciate your kind consideration, if you would, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Are there any questions for the Senator? Thank you for being here today. This time I'll call Rick Winterhalter and Jules Bailey. And welcome, former State Representative Jules Bailey.
You want to be there or here?
I'll be over here today.
You got your...
I brought my shopping with me.
You got your dogs and ponies.
Go right ahead when you're ready.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, Jules Bailey. I am Chief Stewardship Officer for Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative, and I'm blushing. That was actually a very nice panel, and I think there's a lot of agreement on some of the challenges that we see. And I thought Vice Chair Johnson was very gracious in his introduction, and I think did a very nice framing of some of the issues that we're facing. I want to take the opportunity, as long as I have a little bit of a captive audience, to walk through quickly just a brief overview of what's going on with the bottle bill right now, and then dive specifically onto this bill. You'll have a PowerPoint in front of you. I promise I'm not going to go through and hit every slide. I'll leave this with you, but in the interest of time, I'll blow through it pretty quickly. But I think, given that some of us have been doing this for a long time and others are new to it, it would be helpful to have a basic overview before we get down into the details. So who is Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative? We process about 1.2 billion containers a year. We have 5 plants around the state, 300 Oregon employees. We are a cooperative of the beverage industry. We are a private sector cooperative. We currently have an operating budget of about $34 million, and we operate those bottle drop redemption centers that you've heard so much about. We're also a partner in a PET plastic wash and flake facility in St. Helens. So we really control the life cycle of the bottle from the time it leaves the store, or in Bottle Drop's case, the consumer's hands, all the way through to the point where it gets recycled. And we're proud of the fact that 100% of all bottles and cans redeemed in Oregon do get recycled, and many of them get recycled in Oregon. And that's not always true for every kind of recycling. A little bit of the history. As you know, it's 1971. The bottle bill was described as aspirational, not prescriptive, in the sense that there wasn't a lot of meat on the bone about how the bottle bill was written. It was really up to the private sector to figure out how to implement it, and the private sector ran with it, and it's been evolving ever since. 2009, bottled water was added. You've heard about some of the history with the Bottle Drop Redemption Center, and I'd point out 2013 was when that really got going strong, and we think we've made really strong progress since 2013, and I'll talk a little bit about some of that. And then just recently on April 1st, as you may have noticed, we went from 5 cents to 10 cents. And I can tell you, we're still processing the numbers. We're still working through all of the changes that are happening. Obviously, that's a really big change in the bottle bill world. But we saw about double the flow through at our bottle drop facilities in the initial few days. And if you were to project the current redemption rate forward based on what we've seen since April 1st, we'd be at a 93% redemption rate. So the 10 cents is clearly having an effect, and we've been able to accommodate everybody that wants to redeem their bottles and cans, but it has definitely been a lot of interest out there. And then in 2018, as relates to this bill, there is the expansion, and I would agree with the 40% number. So bottle drop centers are the flagship here. That's correct that there's 19. You've seen the map. You'll see another version of it. They're clean. They're nice. If you haven't been to one, go check it out. You can feed your bottles and cans. The machines work. And then we still have the hand count as well at the bottle drop centers. You can do up to 350 per day. It's free. But then we're also really proud of the bottle drop account feature. And this is the green bag program. And for those of you that don't have it, you get one of these cool little key fobs, and it goes on your keychain. You get an account, and you get a roll of stickers with your green bag that has your account number on it. And you just throw all your bottles and cans into the green bag, cinch it up, slap your barcode on it. And when you go by the bottle drop, you just scan your key fob, opens a door, you drop your bag in. We pick that bag up, we sort all the bottles and cans, we count them, and we automatically credit your account. And it's open 24/7 in most places. And in fact, we just have the first bones of, it'll be available later this year, our app. So you'll be able to check your balance on your phone. You'll be able to select featured fundraisers. And in the future, you'll be able to do a bank transfer, put it in your account, maybe send it to a friend, or donate it to any nonprofit in the state of Oregon if that's what you choose to do. You can also just get cash if you want at the bottle drop centers or in stores at the kiosk. We have stores that use the Bottle Drop Plus program where you can get a 20% benefit for the credit if you use it in store. Lots of other available features. As I said, 10 cents has sparked huge demand. These are actual photos I took at a Tigard. Lots of families bringing in their kids. There's sort of an Oregon sense of bringing your kid to show them about recycling and redemption. So this is Bottle Drop Express, and these are the red dots that you saw. So I would absolutely agree with Vice Chair Johnson and with the others who expressed the sentiment that green bag program needs to be available to more Oregonians. And so we, this year, launched Bottle Drop Express. We put our first one in. That's a box that's out in Estacada to bring the convenience of green bag to rural Oregon and more Oregonians. There's a kiosk in the store. You can scan the back of your driver's license. It signs you up for an account. Then it prints you out your bag tags right there, and you can grab your green bags, get them at the counter. And then you just come up to the shipping container. And this one isn't solar powered, but most of them will be solar powered. And you just scan your key fob, open the door, drop it in, and walk away. And we've seen incredible volume in Estacada here. So much so that we've committed to open 12 of these this year. And in fact, we are well along the way to do that. We're in permitting processes right now in Hood River. We've already got the space picked out at Rose Hours to do it. We will be launching our first urban program at Stadium Fred Meyers and Pearl Safeway in Portland, and we'll be putting in several in Columbia County, sure. St. Helens, Scappoose, yeah. Clatskanie. Right now, for the Bottle Drop Express program, we're focused on having these in these initial few months in areas that are easy for us to service if something goes wrong. As you might imagine, we are this is a new technology, this box. We want to make sure if something goes wrong, we're able to get out there really quickly and fix it. But by the end of this year, we'll be going much farther afield, and we've committed to 12 of these a year in addition to the redemption centers that we're building out. So you've seen this map. This is the bottle drop centers. We have 130,000 households statewide with a bottle drop account. That's a map of a bottle drop, every household with a bottle drop account in East Portland. That's a lot of people with bottle drop accounts. And right now, actually, this slide is old. So this slide, 50% of redeemed containers through 19 bottle drop centers. That means of all every container redeemed statewide, 50% of them went through a bottle drop facility. We actually saw that number shift on April 1st. So many more people signed up for a bottle drop account and started coming through that we're now over 60% of every redeemed container comes through a bottle drop facility. This is a much blurry and less cool version of the map that Vice Chair Johnson showed you, so I need to get his technology. But the red are our proposed express locations. The green are the bottle drop locations. We have six bottle drops in centers in process right now around the state, and are very confident that we will have six more centers open this year in addition to our 12 express facilities. All of that material then gets processed by Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative, and I'll skip through some of this. This really, the reason we've been effective at that is that we are vertically integrated and we're able to balance across the system and that we're able to look at a long-run horizon. So what's next for the bottle drop system? We are launching several initiatives. I talked about Bottle Drop Express. Bottle Drop Give is our featured fundraiser program. So nonprofits can get blue bags instead of green bags, give them out to their supporters. They put bottles and cans in there, drop them off, and we credit it to nonprofits. And as you might be interested to know that Snowcap Charities just did 65,000 bottles and cans through the Blue Bag program, and the Humane Society of Redmond is our number one featured fundraiser at 1,365,000 cans that they've redeemed in the last year. So people really, really like this to raise money for their nonprofits. And then a program that we're really excited, that's Bottle Drop Give that we're calling. We're also in a partnership with Sol. To do more litter cleanup around the state in conjunction with the Blue Bag. They get every bottle and can they find. And then we just launched our new bottle drop refill program, which we're really excited about. So the phase one is with Double Mountain Brewery out of Hood River, and their bottles are refillable. So we're going back to the future, and rather than crush and melt down bottles, we will be washing them and reusing them. It's we can actually do, not only is it better for the environment, we'll be able to get bottles to breweries for cheaper than they can buy raw virgin glass from China, and it all stays right in Oregon. So it's actually an economic win as well. Double Mountain's our first pilot. Very quickly, later this year, we'll be ramping up to a bunch of other breweries as well before we go statewide. And in fact, we've had interest from a couple of wineries on being part of this program, despite the fact that the bottle bill doesn't cover wine bottles. It's something we'd love to be partners on as well. I mentioned our Orpet facility that makes plastic up in St. Helens. They're a major partner. So feel free to visit our website for more. Regarding this particular bill, I would agree with a lot of the Vice Chair Johnson. I began this by saying that I agree with your framing and appreciate your gracious framing of this. And we want to ensure that every Oregonian has access to bottle drop, and we're really committed to pushing on this. I would make a few points on it. One, for those of you that were here in 2011, you remember that the container expansion was really an important part of the overall House Bill 3145 that was a fairly well-crafted deal about how we ensure that we are getting more kinds of bottles and cans into the bottle bill system. And I think moving forward with it on the timeline really honors the commitment that the industry made at the time in partnership with the recycling community and the environmental community. But second, one of the challenges that we face is that delaying the expansion could potentially create some uncertainty. And that's uncertainty in two ways. So it's uncertainty for manufacturers. We've already gotten calls from manufacturers that have already begun printing labels with 10 cents. So Trader Joe's, I'll give you a concrete example. They've already started printing 10 cents on some of the products that they sell, and others have done it. So the industry is expecting this. They're gearing up for it. And some of those label costs have already happened. But more than that, it's really about the confusion for the consumer. And this is where I turn to my shopping bag. I kid you not, I pulled this out of my recycling and my green bag this morning. So you'll get to see what we consume in the Bailey household. This is what drives my wife crazy. One of those is redeemable, and one of those is not redeemable. Gatorade is not redeemable. Vitamin water is redeemable. And she cornered me the other day and said, why? And I said, honestly, I cannot explain to you why one of those is redeemable and one of those is not.
Yay, cream.
That's the good beer. One is redeemable, one is not redeemable. This is Freem, one of my favorite breweries, and it's a beautiful bottle. It's thick. It's actually reusable. We'd love to have them in the program for refillable bottles. This is an Angry Orchard Cider. Angry Orchard Cider is not redeemable. And again, I cannot with a straight face explain to you the policy reason of why that is true versus a beer that is redeemable. So the challenge is that consumers, in the face of uncertainty, tend to do nothing. And we think that one of the reasons the redemption rate is down, in addition to obviously the eroding value of the nickel, which we've solved, and redemption opportunities, is that it's not at all clear with the explosion of products in the marketplace what is and isn't redeemable. And in fact, just before this hearing, Marge Gafori turned to me and said, I have agave water. Is that redeemable or not redeemable? And honestly, I have no idea. I have to go back and get a ruling from the OLCC. Having a clear and consistent standard starting soon will help provide some certainty for consumers about what is and what isn't in and allow them to be able to redeem it together. And then finally, if you look at the legislation, the OLCC actually sets a benchmark of 60% for the threshold of when the container expansion would happen. As I mentioned, we've been at 50%. We're now at 60%. And even if the increase hadn't happened with the bottle drops that are opening this year, we would have been at 60% by the end of the year anyway. So we feel that this bill is very well intentioned and certainly appreciate the interest with it, perhaps has some unintended consequences. But the offer that we would make would be we absolutely want to get those bottle drops sited, and especially the express facilities, which work really well in rural areas, and would love to work with you on getting those sited, because we can get those put down pretty quickly, assuming that local government agrees and that we get our zoning and our permitting and all that. We can get those sited pretty quickly. It's just a matter of finding the spots and getting them out there. So 12 coming this year, 6 more redemption centers, and we think we'll be able to handle that capacity in January. So I'll pause there.
Rick, why don't we get your testimony as well now, and then we'll go to questions.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, I'm Rick Winterhalter, with former legislative chair and board chair of the Association of Oregon Recyclers, called out of retirement today to discuss the bottle bill and the bill in front of you.
That sort of makes two of us.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Yeah. And I was going to say that, you know, a lot of talk here of 2011 and 2013. I think we started conversations. The association began having conversations. Chose as a legislative priority modernizing the bottle bill back in 2002, and began having discussions in this building in 2003. And some people in this room, and many who are not, you know, helped us along and obviously made this come to be. And I do as well appreciate Representative Johnson's comments and framing. I think it has been a very successful bill. And I think one of the key things is Jules points out, that the original bottle bill was a great thing of legislative wisdom, and I think it carried through with all the work that was done in the years to come to where we did get to in 2011. That it was, we set dates, we set goals, we said the legislature did all that, and then left it to the industry to make it happen. And as exemplified here today, they have been making it happen. And of course, they've run into some roadblocks, that sort of thing that were unanticipated, but they've moved along, as industry can do, and have really responded to everything that's been put in front of them. And so I think for us, I kind of look at this bill a little bit as a solution, looking for a problem, because we haven't even gotten to the end of what we've asked these folks to do. And I think they're going to get there. And so we're real hopeful. We want to see this continue. There's been a lot of work and effort, by folks to get this bill in the form that it is, that's working, and the industry is responding very positively, and we should stay out of the way and let that happen. And so with that, the association urges a no vote on 3349. Thank you.
Questions from the committee. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the bottle demonstration. That was great. I guess my question goes to, with six more redemption centers opening this year, that exists to 25 out of 45, which is still only 55%. I want to ask what the delay is or why the delay, or would it be better to reach the goal by not doing any more, quote, redemption centers and just focusing on the containers, which seem a lot easier, cheaper, faster to deploy to get to a point where we won't have a problem when January 1st rolls around?
Chair Helm, Representative Reschke, that's a great question and a great point. And it's one of the reasons that we pivoted as well to the Express program. We'll meet our obligations on the main centers because they provide an important hub in areas with really high volume. So we'll continue to do that. And in fact, we had committed to 4 a year. We bumped that up to 6, and we'll be moving forward aggressively on that. Again, it's only been in full implementation since 2013. But we think we can walk and chew gum at the same time and do these express boxes as well really quickly. We've got so many in the chute now that we're actually starting to expand that area that we're looking at for express boxes because they're working really well and people seem to like them. As I mentioned, Columbia County, one of the reasons that we're doing Clatskanie, St. Helens, two in St. Helens, and one in Scappoose, is that'll allow us to test out a little bit some saturation in an area and see how that affects volume. And then we have two in Hood River that are coming. Both of them are underway. And then there's an urban component, too. We've got some urban ones that we're looking at. But I completely agree with you. That's going to be a flagship of ours, and it's pretty plug-and-play to be able to do it. The holdup to the beginning of your question is sort of the same on the express boxes that it's been on the bottle drop centers, and it's a little bit more in micro. It's for the centers, a lot of it is just it's hard to find land in a hot economy that you can buy and then to go through all the different regulations. And so almost every bottle drop center requires kind of a bespoke boutique solution. With all due respect to my friends at League of Oregon Cities and Association of Oregon Counties, it's a real challenge navigating some of the local permitting processes that are different from place to place, and whether or not we're classified as industrial or commercial. So I see this now as sitting on the other side of it. The express boxes don't have quite the same challenges because we're not buying land. They're usually going in a grocery store parking lot or something like that. But there is often still local regulation around them. So, for example, in the Estacada one, we had to go through a design review process to make sure that it felt in the design review standards for the city, and we had to add in some earthquake safety around it. And those are all doable things and things that we're committed to doing, but those standards increase the timeline on each one.
Just a quick follow-up comment, people think Klamath Falls is backwoods, but we do have a redemption center. We're one of the green dots up there, right next to the Tesla charging station. So.
That's the way those people are.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Jules, I really appreciate the report, and as I said, I really enthusiastic about the direction the program's going. I think you guys are on the right track, but I'll come back to my initial point, which is I think that on January 1st, we'll continue to have large sections of the state that just won't have the benefits that other communities do. And I think it's just really impossible, really hard to not acknowledge that. So I will stand with my original point. The other secondary point I would make about this
photo here.
That was going to be my little Easter egg to see who picked that up. So you win.
I don't know.
Isn't that Brian Drucker?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know if this is intended to be the signing. Governor Kitzhaber signing the bottle bill, but I think it was the suntan bill, keeping teenagers away from some tanning beds, because you've got Brian.
I think it was too.
You've got Brian Drucker, Senator Steiner Hayward, Kenny Geyer, and all the healthcare type of people. So, along with Peter Courtney, though, he was there. So, anyway, good try, but
you win the prize of the day. Our PR team had that in the slides. And wait a second, as we were driving down here, that's not a bottle bill signature.
Anyway,
but
it's good shot.
It's too late at that point.
Representative Power.
It's interesting because I read this bill and the phrase convenient service a little bit differently in a way that hasn't been touched on so far. Even in our urban areas, the existing bottle drop centers that have been opened are only open from 9 to 6 p.m. So to me, for folks who are maybe working multiple jobs or have a lot of obligations during those daytime hours, things that end at 6, especially if you're trucking a lot of cans and bottles over, to me, I have some concerns about the accessibility there, mm-hmm. Especially for lower-income individuals or those who may be working multiple different jobs. So I was wondering, for the proposed express centers, are those going to be 24 hours? And then to your map, I was sort of surprised to see that you can dial that closely into account holders. So what kind of personally identifiable information are required to participate in these express centers?
So thank you for your question, Chair Helm, Vice Chair Power. First, on the issue of the hours, all the bottle drop facilities are 24 hours for the green bag program. So if you're an account holder, you can use those drop doors 24 hours a day. There's one exception, I think, of the coming Beaverton one, because the neighborhood really objected to having that be open 24 hours a day. But there are some issues with noise and those sorts of things that for the larger center that keep us from having it open for longer hours. The Bottle Drop Express will be open 24 hours a day for people to be able to use, and that's a great point. And that's one of the reasons we find that people really like the convenience of the green bag program. In the urban area especially, expanding that program has been a priority for us. And I didn't, because the discussion earlier had been more about rural areas, I didn't touch as much on the urban portion of it. But the Express program is as much about the urban area as it is about the rural areas, because, for example, where I live in Multnomah Village, the closest bottle drop facility to me is in Tigard, and it's a bit of a hike. And I'm really looking forward to the one on Beaverton Hillsdale Highway that's opening May 26th. That'll be a lot closer to me. But land is really expensive in urban areas, as you know, and tight, and it's very difficult to site. And so we're partnering with grocery stores to do, instead of the full shipping container, essentially, for lack of a better phrase, we've been calling them cages, that are at the grocery store next to the or near the reverse vending machines that have the same drop door and are sort of built into the wall. You can scan your fob and open that up and drop it in on your way to the grocery store and then get your bottle drop plus on the way out. So we think that'll be something that people will really like, and that's coming to a couple of Portland stores in the next couple of months. And then to the question about personally identifiable data, you do have to sign up with your with a driver's license or an ID, Oregon ID card. These are accounts that are holding financial information. If you don't want to sign up for an account, you can use the vending machines without using an account, but we do require an address and contact info for people that are signing up for the bottle drop accounts. Now, that's not we're a private entity. We keep that data close. We don't share that or market that or sell that to people, and it's not available via, say, a public records request or something like that. But we do require that for our account holders.
Thank you, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great seeing you here again.
Good to see you.
Did I see a green dot up there on Ontario?
You did.
And is that imaginary, a hope? Is that like tomorrow? When?
It's very much in process. And Representative Benz, Chair Helm, Representative Benz, you may know that there has been a big change in the, or a coming change in the retail environment in Ontario. You have a very large new retailer that is going to come in to Ontario. And the bottle drop centers require the sort of sign on the dotted line from the retailers in that area. We'd made a lot of progress on that, and we're getting very close on moving forward. The change in the retail environment made us have to go back and go around. It changes the math on the bottle drop. But we fully expect the Ontario site to be open by the end of the year.
And just a short follow-up. Thank you. Well, thank you for that. I was just getting texts in from the various grocery stores in Ontario. The manager of the Little Red Apple store, they hate it, are frustrated with the number of people coming across the border, which has now doubled. The same is true for the Little Winco that just opened up. The increased number of people bringing in bottles has doubled. And so that's been the case and will continue to be. So we desperately need to have you, your group, fronting all those people from Idaho. Because when this thing does expand, it's going to be unbelievably difficult. So very, very happy you're going to be there.
We're committed to it, Chair Helm, Representative Benz. And to the issue of fraud, it's a little bit of a balance in that we don't, on an individual basis, if a customer brings in a few cans and they've got a Washington license plate or an Idaho license plate, and it's just a few cans, we don't make a habit of interrogating our customers. We give them the benefit of the doubt and let them in. They're pulling up in a pickup truck with a bunch of bags in it, and it's an out-of-state license plate or something like that. We're going to go out and ask them some questions. But we are regulated in our ability to accept or not accept bottles and cans. But we've been able to – I won't go into all the detail on the public record of exactly what our security measures are on it. But we do have ways of ferreting that out. And I'll give you one example. The closest Oregon Costco to you is in Portland, I believe. And so highly unlikely to see large volumes of Kirkland water bottles coming back through Ontario that are legitimately purchased. And that's one marker of something that we look for and are able to identify. But there are always exceptions. We had a complaint from somebody in your district who was redeeming a Kirkland water bottle and was asked questions about it. Well, it turned out they'd been on a road trip visiting family in Medford and purchased a water bottle and had brought them back in the car and wanted their dimes back. Well, we honor that and we give it to them. There are always exceptions. But within that balancing act, we are very committed to making sure there isn't systemic or wide-scale fraud.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much for being here today. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you for the time.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 3349. I'm going to carry over the work session on 3349 to Monday, April 17th.
What number?
32.
One we just heard.
At this time, I'll open a work session on House Bill 3202.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 3202, there's a -4 amendment on OLIS that replaces the measure. It establishes the procedures and requirements in the Act expressly preempt any charter imposed vote requirement and are only procedures and requirements related to the construction and operation of the Southwest Corridor Max Light Rail project that the project shall be subject to. It establishes other process and review notice requirements. There's a fiscal statement that was just issued and is available on OLIS, and a no revenue impact statement and a request that the bill be sent to Ways and Means.
I would entertain a motion on the -4 amendment.
Chair Helm, I move to adopt the -4 amendments dated April 10th, 2017.
Representative Power moves to adopt the -4 amendments dated April 10, 2017. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Helm, I move House Bill 3202 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Power moves House Bill 3202 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be a no on this, not because I don't like Portland and I don't like Max or I don't like light rail, but we're moving mountains here. And we're going to have to move mountains again. I won't be moving mountains until the cows come home. I think I just mixed metaphors there. But my issue is we should deal with the root cause, which is all these regulations that are in the way of getting something done. And so I know that won't stop this, and I don't want to stop it, but I'm just going to vote no to send a message that we should deal with root issues, not putting Band-Aids over stuff.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benton?
Aye.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Mirsky?
Nay.
Representative Brocksmith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Donovan?
Aye.
Vice Chair Howard?
Aye.
Chair Holmes?
Aye. The motion passes, and the bill will be sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Still no paperwork on Pam's bill. Okay. At this time, I'm going to open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3227. And so, can you tell us a little bit about this bill, and then I'll invite.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 3227 would allow a tax credit for an alternative energy device to be claimed by the owner or subscriber of a community solar project. There's a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue and a fiscal statement and revenue statement issued on the measure.
Okay. I think at this time I'll invite Jeff Bissonette and Max Mueller up, and any folks that you've brought to assist you could come up at this time. Welcome.
Thanks.
We lose Max.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Bissonette with the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. And yes, my colleague and Max Mueller and I both signed up because we weren't quite sure who was going to be in the room when you called the bill. But either of us were ready. Thank you for the opportunity to have a hearing and a discussion on this bill. As many, if not all of you know, last year the legislature adopted a policy to establish a community solar program in Oregon. Since then, we've been busy writing the rules over at the Public Utility Commission for that program. And as we dealt with it and looked at other states and looked at how community solar might be happening in Oregon, we started to notice a couple of key policy questions that we thought were relevant to discuss. Community solar is going to be, I think, the way that folks that can't have solar on their roof for a variety of reasons, either it's too shady or they rent the roof or any of a number of other reasons. They can't put the solar on the roof and therefore can't access a residential energy tax credit to help them do that. Community solar is going to allow people to buy into a larger project to offset up to their usage and get a credit on their utility bill for their share of the output of the particular project that they're subscribing to, much like they would get the net metering credit on their bill if they had solar on their roof. And so it's very exciting. There are a lot of people that are looking to participate in community solar in terms of the development side, and you're going to hear from one of those companies here in just a minute. But as we started to look at the program from the point of view of the potential participant, subscriber, customer, we thought that there might be an opportunity to talk about the possibility of whether it's good policy to have those folks have access to some kind of incentive. It doesn't have to be just like the RETC. In fact, I think that it will probably look a lot different than the RETC for a variety of reasons. One is that you can take advantage of the economies of scale from larger projects, and so you don't need as much incentive to make a difference for people to participate. There's going to be a lot of tracking of the output of the projects, because that's what's going to define the bill credit. And so for incentives, people tend to like incentive or production-based incentives. And so you can really pay for the clean electrons that are coming out of these solar projects and provide tax credits or some incentive based on that output. Those sort of topics are kind of conversations for the revenue discussion, and whether or not whether it's good policy if we have money at all to pursue that policy. But the question that we wanted to bring before the committee today is it good policy to allow subscribers to community solar projects some kind of tax incentive? And if that you think it is good policy, then we can have the conversation with many of you on the committee on, you know, what that might cost, and again, if that fits within the state budget this session. With that, I'll stop there. I'm happy to answer questions, but also joined by one of our members who is a community works for a community solar developer in other states, and has been working very hard with the rest of the industry and other community solar advocates on the rulemaking.
Okay, go right ahead. Yep.
Thank you, Chair Helm and representatives of the committee. My name is Charlie Cogashaw. I'm a senior policy analyst for Clean Energy Collective. I've been in the solar industry for about 10 years. About half of that was on the federal side with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory and U.S. Department of Energy. A few years with a nonprofit in the Southeast, and then with Clean Energy Collective, CEC, for the past 2 years. I'm a board member on the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association, and I live in Portland, Oregon. And so I've been actively engaged in legislative efforts and regulatory efforts related to the community solar program here in the state. Yeah. Clean Energy Collective was founded in 2009, and we're based out of Louisville, Colorado. We are the leading community solar developer and solutions provider in the country, and have partnered with 27 utilities serving thousands of customers across at least 12 states. We cover the full gamut of community solar development, from software solutions to project development to administering the customer acquisition process and ongoing customer service for projects. We do all of it. We're one of the few kind of pure play community solar developer companies in the country. As I say, our engagement in Oregon has been going on the past few years at the legislative level and at the regulatory level, and I am deeply involved in the regulatory process right now for determining the rules for the legislation that Jeff mentioned was passed last year. We are very excited about the prospects for a community solar program in the state. And I know we're not alone in that. As a member of OSEA, I know there's plenty of Oregon-based solar companies that are looking to get into this market segment. In addition, we're members, Clean Energy Collective is members of the Coalition for Community Solar Access, which is the trade association for community solar development companies. And I know I actually coordinate a working group through that organization, and there are many companies at the national level that are also eagerly awaiting the final rules from this program. Our experience from other markets is that when the economics are reasonable, community solar is extremely successful, in large part for many of the reasons that Jeff has mentioned, but it provides a flexible solar option that customers want or need in the case of renters or those lacking adequate property. It obviously provides an opportunity to reduce your electricity costs if those economics are reasonable. And that has been the driver for solar development across the country, is reducing their electricity costs. Greenhouse gas emission reduction is another benefit. I think we're all aware of those benefits. But corporate entities involved in community solar projects might see additional benefits from participating in projects if they have corporate sustainability goals or targets. So why incentives for this community solar program? It is, I'll make the disclaimer that the economics for this program are still quite uncertain. We don't have a credit rate, which is sort of at the core of a community solar program, and the value proposition that's going to be offered to the customers. It is, based on the legislation, it should be reflective of the value of solar. That's a separate docket that's going on, uncertain when that's going to be finalized versus when the final tariffs will be finalized for the program. There might be a mismatch there and a need to improvise with a different rate. That said, using conservative assumptions, we, and I know other developers, have some concerns with the economics in the program here in the state. And this is particularly true when thinking about the inclusion of smaller customers, such as residential customers. And sort of point being that in Colorado, there is no kind of requirement for residential participation. And 90% or so of the customers that have been participating in that program, which is, has been one of the larger programs in the country, has been focused on commercial customers. And the reason for that is because customer acquisition is much more expensive for smaller customers. There's more customers to market to, more contracts to sign, and more customers to provide customer service to over a length of a contract, which could be 20 or more years. So that's an issue. Clean Energy Collective is one of the few companies that actually advocates for carve-outs for smaller customers in projects to ensure that they're not left out of the mix. And looking at the rules, the draft rules that PUC staff released last week, I think they're in have a similar kind of policy in mind. That said, it does add to the cost of a project because of that customer acquisition cost and ongoing customer service cost. And so providing some sort of incentive, at least in the near term, and as Jeff says, these incentives don't need to be as high as the RETC or the Energy Trust of Oregon provides a rebate. We don't need, Community Solar has bigger projects. We have good economies of scale relative to a rooftop project. But in the near term, incentives, I think, would play an important role in ensuring small customer support or engagement in a project. And in cases where, you know, that small customer participation is required, it might be the tipping point for enabling the economics of the project to go forward in the first place. So we view this as a very real issue in the state, and at least enabling that option for providing incentives to ensure the program is successful would be a wise step for the state. A final point is just on the point of sort of equity. And so we have, you know, RETC and other incentives that have been offered in the state to customers that have the ability to put a solar system on their roof or to make some other sort of renewable energy or energy efficiency investment. The beauty of community solar is that it's something that could potentially be an opportunity provided to all customers in the state. And of course, you know, the current program is focused on investor-owned utilities, but I think an incentive that would be offered to all customers, residential customers in the state, might trigger more co-ops or municipal utilities to be producing or developing their own programs to get involved. It is cost effective. You're reaching more people at a less cost from an incentive basis, and it's scalable. And as I say, I don't view this as something that's going to be needed for a decade. I think the cost of solar is continuing to drop, and that's something that we would be scaling down as well from an incentive basis. But I do think it would be an important initial step for ensuring this is a successful program in the state. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Representative Holby.
Yeah, thank you. I do appreciate you testifying on this. I note that I did introduce this bill for the discussion point. I think this, we need to keep moving forward with this discussion. As the dust settles around our incentive programs, you know, I think it behooves us to reinvent some of our incentive programs, and this is one that makes a lot of sense to me, where residential customers can have access on their rooftop, but not in a community solar project at this point. And so I think with the economies of scale you discussed, this would really be a great place to look at for developing incentives in the future. So I really welcome that conversation.
Further questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'll invite up Miles Pengilly and Jason Heuser.
Chair Helm and members of the committee, for the record, Miles Pengilly testifying on behalf of the of Renewable Northwest. We've also submitted a letter of testimony on OLIS. Renewable Northwest is a regional nonprofit organization committed to the responsible development of renewable energy resources in Oregon and throughout the Pacific Northwest. And our diverse membership is a combination of renewable energy businesses and environmental and consumer groups. We're pleased to support House Bill 3227. Community solar programs across the country increase opportunities for individuals and businesses to invest in clean solar energy projects and receive direct benefit on their utility bills. And Renewable Northwest supports a flexible community solar program that will lead to the installation of more solar projects across the state. These projects benefit not only the communities where the projects are built, but also the companies and the workers who build those projects. For many Oregonians, ultimately the cost of participation is going to be a key factor in deciding whether or not to subscribe to a community solar project, and House Bill 227 will help drive participation in those community solar projects by decreasing that cost to participate. So for that reason, Renewable Northwest supports House Bill 3227's aim of applying the renewable energy tax credit to community solar projects. I also want to say, in reference to Representative Holvey's comments, that we're also supportive of a broader conversation regarding the appropriate type of incentive to support community solar going forward. We believe that this bill is a strong start to a larger conversation about restructuring our existing incentives and also possibly creating new incentives to drive participation in the state's community solar programs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Helm, Vice Chairs Johnson and Power, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to comment. For the record, I'm Jason Heuser, Government Relations Liaison for the Eugene Water and Electric Board. We're a consumer-owned utility, a municipal, serving 88,000 customers in Eugene and the McKinsey River Valley. I want to thank Representative Holvey for bringing this bill forward. I think it's an important issue. We know there's a lot of interest in our service territory in community solar. I can vouch for that through an experience EWEB had through the Solarize Eugene program. We're a consumer-owned utility, so by definition, we're responsive to the values of our customers. In Eugene, our customers are supportive of solar. We supported the Solarize Eugene effort, which was a series of limited-time, volunteer-driven community efforts designed to give participants an opportunity to do bulk purchasing, you know, where you get blocks of maybe 100 people together, you get that bulk purchasing discount, bring down the cost of installing the solar. It was a very successful program. In that Solarize Eugene effort, hundreds of households signed up expressing interest. As those folks attended the workshops, a significant number of folks learned that they actually don't have solar access for the reasons that were enumerated earlier. I won't repeat those. So a lot of folks, unfortunately, found out they're in the shade, so to speak, on this one. And we think there's an opportunity to meet that demand of those customers that don't have that solar access. One of the limiting factors I think we've seen is there's two consumer-owned utilities that have actually developed projects already. I believe Lane Electric Cooperative in Representative Holvey's district has gone forward with a project, and there should be a second project over in Central Oregon. I believe it's Central Electric Cooperative. I've taken a look at the sort of case study on how their project has turned out, and it's mixed results. I mean, they've had some success, but the payback period, at least for the project in Central Oregon that I'm familiar with, it was around 36 years. That's not really in the range that's going to lead to successful subscription outcomes. They have not gotten that project fully subscribed, as I understand. So getting that payback period down to a range that's closer to the kind of payback period you're seeing for traditional rooftop PV solar installations would be really instrumental in terms of getting successfully subscribed projects in consumer-owned utility territory. I don't know that you have to have the same payback, as Jeff alluded to, or the same type of parity afforded to community solar that folks that get the RETC-y get, but any measure of parity is going to help us get that payback period down to allow projects to have successful outcomes and be hopefully fully subscribed. So again, I applaud the efforts, appreciate Representative Holley moving this bill forward. We know funds are scarce and hard to come by in the current state budget situation, but I think absolutely, you know, community solar merits discussion as you folks redesign the tax credit programs. Thanks for the opportunity to comment.
Questions for this panel?
Great. Thank you, gentlemen.
Can I open it?
Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3227 and open a work session on House Bill 3227. And entertain a motion on this bill.
Chair Helm, I move House Bill 3227 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Representative Power moves House Bill 3227 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there a discussion? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can support moving this bill to revenue, but I do want to say that there are a lot of questions that need to be answered here, and I really think the conversation, I mean, I guess I'd be reluctant to see this situation move forward before the PUC completes their docket on the value of solar. I think that's a key component. Secondly, I think there's all other questions regarding, does it only apply to homeowners? Would renters be able to buy in if they move from one jurisdiction to another or one utility to another? Does that credit follow them? I don't know. It seems to me like there's a lot of questions to be answered here, and we can try to take those up in revenue, but again, it's a fresh committee, that, with the exception of a few of us, but it's going to be a challenging conversation to have, but we can move it and see what happens.
Very good. Further comments? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I think the key point of this committee's action is to tell the revenue committee, by sending the bill or not sending it, whether the committee thinks this is a worthwhile enterprise. I think Representative Johnson's comments are very germane, but they can be dealt with directly in the revenue committee.
Very good. Representative Power?
Yes, I'd like to follow up on Representative Johnson's comments. I, too, in speaking with some of the advocates, value renewables, but have some concerns that this would expand an existing tax credit that doesn't currently have a cap. Mm-hmm. Without having a clear idea on what the total cost to the state that would be. And after hearing Representative Marsh's bill yesterday, 3241, thought there were some creative ways that LIDs could be formed to take on the cost themselves and spread those payments of community solar over a longer period of time and engage that way. I know it's something my constituents are very interested in, so I think there are options. I think the right location, though, is revenue to have this discussion.
Any other comments, questions? Okay. If there's no further discussion, will the clerk call the roll, please?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
Excused.
Representative Colby?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Rushke?
Aye.
Representative Brocksmith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Power?
Aye.
Chair Hall?
Aye. The motion passes, and the House Bill 3227 will be referred to the Committee on Revenue. And we had a couple more things on our schedule today, but I think we've had a lot of long committee sessions, and I'm going to leave that work for Monday. And so I'm going to carry over the work session Let's see. I guess I need to open a working session on House Bill 2020 and carry over the work session on House Bill 2020 to April 17th. And I'm going to open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3312. And I'm going to carry over the public hearing and work session on House Bill 3312 to April 17th. We have been waiting for. I'll beg your indulgence for a couple more. No. We've been waiting for the paperwork on Representative Marsh's bill, House Bill 3241, to extend the PACE program, but it's still not ready. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3241 and carry over the work session on House Bill 3241 to April 17th, 2017. Question from Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I may have missed it, but I don't have a note on 2471. Did I just miss that?
That bill is not moving forward.
It is not. Okay. Just making sure that we didn't miss one.
Thank you.
I have a note on everything else on the agenda.
Okay. Thank you for double-checking my work. The last thing I'll say, if there are any measures on today's agenda not voted out of the committee today, they are carried over to my next agenda. And with that, I'm going to close the House Committee on Energy and Environment. House Committee on Energy.